welcome to the Medical Narratives Podcast with Dr. Michael Gordon. I'm Regina Starr, and in today's episode, we will continue our series on the top 10 issues affecting the elderly. We are excited to present another informative episode on the topic of forgetfulness and mild cognitive impairment. This is a topic that affects many older adults and their families. As our population continues to age, it's becoming increasingly common for people to experience memory lapses and cognitive changes. According to the Alzheimer's Society of Canada, an estimated 10 to 15% of Canadians over the age of 65 have mild cognitive impairment. The prevalence of mild cognitive impairment increases with age, with studies suggesting that up to 25 to 50% of people over the age of 85 may also have it. It's worth noting that mild cognitive impairment can be difficult to diagnose, and some individuals may not seek medical attention for their symptoms. As a result, the true prevalence of mild cognitive impairment in the Canadian or North American population may be higher than reported. While forgetfulness can be a normal part of aging, it can also be a symptom of more serious conditions, such as mild cognitive impairment or even dementia. It's important for doctors to understand the nuances of forgetfulness and cognitive decline, and to be able to provide patients with accurate information and effective interventions. Today, in my conversation with Dr. Gordon, he will shed light on this complex and often misunderstood topic. So let's get started. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. Oh, I should say good afternoon. Fine, thank you.
Good. So what are the common causes of forgetfulness in older adults, and when should be a cause for concern?
This is a very complex topic, and as you mentioned in your introduction, becoming more readily recognized, and we now realize how common it is. It's probably one of the great challenges of the future of society and whatever you want to call it, healthcare, medicine, and of course, the effect on families, individuals, and family dynamics. When I was in medical school, which is not a million years ago, but a while ago, we didn't really take much attention to somebody who had cognitive impairment. And I can remember in very strong Scottish Dundee accent, if somebody was like that, they say, "Oh, he's a wee bit dotty." And the term that was used was senile, senility. The term Alzheimer's wasn't part of the vocabulary in that what was originally defined as Alzheimer's by Professor Alzheimer, Alois Alzheimer, was what now we probably call presenile dementia, early onset. In fact, the patient he wrote about, he published, was probably now early onset dementia, not the common that we see that increases with aging. But it really wasn't acknowledged as something, it wasn't even considered in a sense, an illness. It was just part of getting old. Didn't affect everybody, but affected a lot. And as I moved through my medical training and different healthcare systems, as I went from place to place and moved up the educational ladder, it became clearer and clearer as each decade passed that this was not only a real issue, but it was a definable issue. It got categorized finally as you might say, an illness. And the question became is, when is it an illness? And when is it, you might say, in quotes, a normal part of aging? And I can remember when we actually used the word benign forgetfulness. So if somebody came to you who was 75 or 80 and said, you know, I sometimes can't find a word and I forget the names of people I know, you say, well, you know, at your age, it's benign forgetfulness. And then as we watched these people, we saw them transform from what we would call, or we called benign forgetfulness, to something more serious, until it got to the point that they weren't able to remember much of what happened recently. They often could remember their past, and they would sometimes, and the family would complain, they're always talking about their past. Now, some teams like to talk about the past. I do as part of a historical narrative. Mm-hmm. But talking about your past, but not, I used to hear somebody who said, the family said, he can remember the trip to America, but he can't remember what he had for breakfast an hour after he has breakfast. where she has breakfast. So the status now, if you want to call it a status, is we recognize a spectrum. A spectrum means like in the light, from dark to light, all the colors in between. And the spectrum has more and more pieces to it, rather than strict categories. And I just had a discussion with somebody with whom I'm working in a memory clinic about something that I was recognizing some years ago, and which is in the literature, and it's called subjective cognitive impairment. What is subjective cognitive impairment? Well, subjective means I feel that I am not as good as I was. Now you might say, well, what do you expect? You can't run as fast. You can't bicycle as fast. But when somebody says, I can't think as fast, you say, well, what do you expect? And yet we know there are people who are in their late 80s and 90s who can speak and think and play chess. I saw an interview on television the other day of a woman who was 101. Well, she was as eloquent as anybody I could imagine. So we can't just say it's a normal part of aging. But subjective cognitive impairment is interesting because the person feels there's something wrong. But when we test them in our usual way, and it's a rough way, these cognitive tests, MoCA, mini mental status, we have it as standardized. They do very well. And if you speak to them, you don't see anything other than an occasional forgetting a name. But we all do that. I mean, I always categorize people as those who never forget names, that's my wife, and people who always forget names, that's me. And my wife, who never forgets names, also remembers the name of the dog, because that's the way she's programmed. But a person who was normally acting and thinking right and says there's something wrong, but when you test them, you can't find anything and it doesn't interfere with their work or their driving or their cooking, you sort of say, well, what is it? So it's called subjective cognitive impairment. And the question is, does that lead to something? Because if you follow, it may lead to what we called mild. And always funny when you use the word mild, you know, I say, well, what's the definition of mild? It's not big, it's not small, it's in the middle. Mild cognitive impairment. So in mild cognitive impairment, not only does a person realize there's something wrong, they have insight, but when you test them, you find little holes in their memory, in their recall. I mean, simple tests. You know, you say, here's five numbers, you repeat it one time, you repeat it, and they say, well, say them backwards. Most people can do that. So mild cognitive impairment, usually there's some recognition. The test shows something, but still people are managing. They're managing well. They're working, they're cooking, they're this. They can still drive. There's no evidence that the driving is necessarily impaired. Although there's some questions about it. And one of the things that's disturbing it right now, there aren't any symptomatic treatments for it because the drugs we now have for dementia, which aren't great, but they do something in some people, don't do anything in mild cognitive impairment. Then if you follow these people, they often transform into what we call mild dementia, moderate dementia, serious dementia, and late stage dementia. So these are the people we all recognize as somebody we know or in our family who often end up needing full-time care, either at home with full-time care or in a nursing home with full-time care. We often find that they get to the point they can't communicate and make sense unless somebody knows very well. They can't remember. Some of the tests I use, can you remember the name of your children? Now, most, especially mothers, fathers may not even remember the name from the beginning. I'm joking. Mothers remember the name of their children. They remember the name and the place in the birth sequence. When a woman forgets the name of her child, that's something. Forgetting the name of your grandchild happens because you don't see them that often. With the child, then the husband, then themselves, and then they stop recognizing people. Facial recognition usually goes on to the very end. So this becomes you might say, late stage dementia. And then we have what's called the end of life terminal dementia. And there are people who say, well, Alzheimer's isn't a terminal disease. And I say, no, that's not, we don't talk about a terminal disease. We say a disease that has a terminal phase. Mm-hmm. Like they used to say cancer is a terminal disease. Now, cancer is a terminal disease if it doesn't respond to treatment at the end. But you can say, you know, I know people who've had cancer who didn't die. And then maybe 10 years later, it comes back and they go through it. And then it's called the terminal phase of cancer rather than cancer is a terminal disease. So that's the spectrum we look at now.
So how can a doctor distinguish between forgetfulness due to mild cognitive impairment and other medical conditions such as depression or even medication side effects? Yeah.
So this is an important part of the evaluation. And this is very important. And those of us who've been in the field, I do it as a geriatrician. I have colleagues who are behavioral neurologists or care of the elderly family physicians. So we are alert and often are asked to see people who somebody recognizes that there's an impairment, either the person, like I just saw somebody recently, who recognized that she is forgetful, even though her tests are all perfect. Or I saw another person recently who thinks everything's fine, but the daughter says, doesn't remember 5 minutes from another, but still recognizes me, but not my children. So the doctor has to be alert to it and not brush things off. We have to get away from the idea that everything's normal. That doesn't mean you start saying, oh my God, you come in, you forgot your telephone number. But somebody who's beginning or somebody saying there are problems, then the doctor has to say, okay, what can it be? Like everything in medicine. You take the history, the story. I mean, example, you know, I was ill a few years ago, and it was diagnosed as rapid onset cognitive impairment. I went from a Thursday that I did a full clinic to a Sunday that I was in the emergency room in St. Michael's Hospital. Right? I was all mixed up. My wife was very upset. She called two people, a nephew who's a geriatrician and a brother who's a family doctor, said, what should I do? He said, well, you take him to eMERGE. Now, the original person who saw me with my story said, rapid onset, cognitive impairment, possible delirium. Now, anybody who knows the stories, and you've heard me talk about this, the most important part of medicine, separate from the personal story, is the story of the illness. The story of the illness. Every illness has a story. It may have different kinds of stories. There are mystery stories. There are romantic stories. There are different kinds of stories, but certain stories, like if an 8-year-old child wakes up in the middle of the night, because this happened to one of my children, he wasn't 8, he was 6, 5, crying that he has pain. And it starts suddenly, and he says, don't touch my belly. You know, from that story, give or take a little, he's probably got appendicitis. You know, you have to examine and do things, but that's a story, right? Somebody who says, you know, I've been smoking for 20 years and I had smoker's cough, but what's the worry of that? But you know, now I can't walk up the stairs. You know, when you look at them and you find that they're breathing with their lips pursed, as we said, you know, that's probably bronchitis emphysema. That's the story before you even examine them. So the story of somebody who's got memory problems is, how long has it been going on? What's its course? Is it slowly, slowly, slowly getting worse? Or is it sudden, like it was with me, that turned out to be due to a drug? It was called chemo brain from chemotherapy I was getting. So you hear the story, and then as the physician, you say, well, what are the risk factors? What are the risk factors? What's going on? So you notice that, for example, which is what happened with me, except the doctor didn't recognize it. It took me getting better enough to look it up that I was on chemotherapy. Well, a doctor who knows somebody's on chemotherapy says, wait a second, maybe this is chemo brain. Well, no. Somebody who was started on sleeping pills a month ago because they had trouble sleeping, you say, really? You're on Xanax? Hardly use it anymore. But, you know, people do with the varia lorazepam, with Ativan, Valium, which was the first, you know, it's hardly used that much anymore for that kind of condition. Say, gee, that's strange. And sometimes it's drugs that you don't even think about because there are medications that are called something else, but they may have an effect on cognition and memory and mood. So you have to look at the story. Environmental story, somebody says, you know what? I got hit in the head while I was skiing. I'm not going to talk about what's in the press these days. And I was unconscious for a few minutes, but I'm okay. But since then, I've had a problem. You have to say, wait, maybe they had a brain injury, a concussion. Okay. Or somebody says, you know what? My heart was beating fast, suddenly. You say, gee, maybe they threw an embolus from atrial fibrillation. So you have to know the story. And based on the story, you do the investigations. And the investigations are the physical. Like if you examine somebody and you find they've got neurological findings that they didn't have before, that may mean some damage to the brain. If you look and they have a gait that looks like a Parkinsonian gait but was never recognized, say, gee, maybe they have Parkinson's. Or maybe you knew they had Parkinson's and they were started on medication. And one of the side effects of medication can be problems with memory. So you have to look at the story. Once you've looked at the story, then you'll decide on the tests. Now, there used to be a kind of algorithm for testing people who come in with gradual onset dementia. And one of them, make sure they don't have a metabolic cause. What's a metabolic cause? Something within the chemicals of the body or the hormones. And the topical ones that were always looked at was thyroid disease, especially an older person. Why? Thyroid disease in older people can be very insidious, both hyper and hypo. Insidious meaning very gradual. So you have to look for that, take the history. And nowadays, the blood test, of all the tests that give you a yes or no answer, that's a simple test. And in my career, I have seen many people who had hypothyroidism as the cause of their symptoms, one of which was slowness in thinking. Now, they had other slownesses in their walking. So that's an example. Even though it's unusual, vitamin B12 deficiency, if extreme, can cause it. Usually there are other symptoms. Sometimes things like elevated calcium can do it, but usually there are other signs. Sometimes you have to do imaging of the brain, and you find something that you didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can think of the unusual ones over my career, but usually you find something in the brain that says, gee, that's not right. Now, shrinkage of the brain alone in the elderly isn't the diagnosis. It's very common, and it isn't necessarily correlated with cognition. But if you find changes in the blood vessels called micro little angiopathy, that may be a characteristic of people with later dementia.
Very interesting. So are there risk factors for developing mild cognitive impairment, and can it be prevented? So perhaps you can speak to the role of exercise, diet. Can they potentially reduce the risk of mild cognitive impairment?
So there are things you might say, it's the idea of on the one hand, in the other hand, and then somebody says, well, what about the third hand? So the things that increase the risk of dementia, we have recognized some of them only recently. You know, it's only recently, and there was a movie, of course, made out of that was quite controversial, that head injuries of the kind you get in sports and are repeated turn out to be a significant risk factor in developing dementia. So when you think of what happens to boxers, football players, soccer players, injuries in a developing brain from hitting a ball is not good. And when you watch soccer players at the high level, when they hit a ball, that is a head injury. It may be minor, but many of them, now we've learned that football players, despite the helmets they wear, and hockey players, they're getting head injuries all the time. So those are the positive risk factors. There are certain illnesses that may also increase the risk of dementia. Then there's the genetics although true Alzheimer's isn't genetically determined, it's a, you might say, a montage of the various genes you have. If you have four grandparents, all of whom had dementia, you got a pretty good chance. And nowadays, we can actually measure some tests that show an increased risk, not a definite it will be. But there are subsets of people who have a genetic marker for people who develop young age dementia. And I can remember having a patient who came with four sons. And the patient had severe dementia in his 50s. And when I spoke to the sons, and they were from overseas, they knew that they had uncles with dementia. And I said, I'm pretty sure this is a genetic base. And I asked them if they wanted to be tested. And they all said, no. I said, why not? I said, we don't want to know. Because they know. You don't want to know, but you know what your family history, and you're a male, and all the men in your father's side of the family. So there are risk factors. Now, on the other hand, and I just heard a presentation yesterday by somebody I work with, I used to work with at Baycrest, looking at what can you do? Because people come to me, and they have a mother with dementia. And I remember one woman in particular who was terrified. And she came, she says, what can I do? My mother has dementia. Her sister has dementia. What can I do? Can I take something? Well, we don't have any medications yet, although these are being looked at for people who have, for example, subjective cognitive impairment. There are now trials to see if certain drugs, if you start them early enough, may prevent dementia 20 years later, but that means a person has to take this drug for 5, 10, 15 years. That's a lot. But there are studies going on. There's a new drug that was recently approved by the American FDA. But it'll take a while before we know. But in the meanwhile, what can you do? And I remember speaking to the woman. I said, look, this woman, I said, we don't know what you can do for sure, but we know what kind of things decrease the risk. So let's start with simple ones. You can choose your genes, but you can choose how you eat. And eating matters. And for those of us who don't think about food, now it's become more and more acceptable for people to say, I'm not going to eat this, I'm not going to eat that, for various reasons. Some people are keto, they think keto is good for them. Some people say, my God, keto is the worst thing on earth. A lot of people think the Mediterranean type diet is good. Why? It decreases animal fats. It decreases other foods, processed foods for sure. Mm-hmm. So that whole move, not so much organic, that's a whole other story. But you might say natural. My late father died at 99. He had dementia for the last 6 or 7 years. He smoked, which we'll get to, but he stopped in his 30s. But the thing about him, and he was before his time, he loved raw vegetables, peppers, carrots, green beans. He even ate raw potatoes. Now, raw potatoes is to be pushing it. But he ate raw. And the other thing, he made his own yogurt. So we know that exercise is good. What exercise? I always tell people, any exercise. You don't have to join a gym, spend $60 a month, and run yourself into a sweat to exercise. If you walk, that's good. 1-2 kilometers a day. They say that walking in nature is good for the brain. I can understand that. Listening to birds while you walk is even better. So walking is good. If you cycle, so diet. I mean, right now, for my own reasons, I'm on a very low carbohydrate diet. I have almost no meat and chicken, and I eat fish, canned fish, frozen fish. Occasionally, you know, it's almost a specialty, fresh fish, but it doesn't have to be fresh. As long as it's well-prepared, well-taken care of, fish is good. And vegetables and salads, depending on what my opportunities are. So food, exercise, coffee's come and gone. I used to dread every time I read a article said that coffee's a risk factor. I said, oh my God, I love coffee. So coffee's probably okay. The whole thing about alcohol goes back and forth and back and forth. They say a little alcohol is good for you. Now they're saying a little alcohol is not good for you. I think anything that affects the brain that's a drug is probably best to stay away from. I know that marijuana is used. I'm aware of it, and it's legal for, and it may be useful for some medical reasons, but there's some evidence that early onset use is not great for the brain. So that's the things of what people can do. And the other thing, and it's not been proven, but there's indirect evidence that using your brain is, now you might say, well, that's intuitive. Like, who's so smart to invent that one? Using your brain. And what does using your brain mean? Challenging it. So they now suggest, and people ask me, and I say, can't hurt, because it's fun. Crossword puzzles. Sudoku, whatever?
Yes.
My wife is very interested. She does all the puzzles. She used to do cryptic crosswords. Now she does Wordle every day. And these are good. Games, Scrabble. Why? Because it challenges the brain. And one of the ones that's really interesting is learning another language. So these are the pluses and minuses of what people, the important thing is they have in control. If they can control, you can only do things that you can control. Things you can't control, you can't make yourself crazy about. But if you can control something, like smoking, I mean, I'm a big advocate of non-smoking, non-smoking rules, non-smoking laws. I think if I can get somebody that's not smoking, I've done something useful. If it's a woman, I said, you know, smoking is not just bad for your lungs and cancer, it's terrible for your skin. You spend all this money on skin creams, the most important, and they say, yeah, I want to stop. So I said, so do it. Blame it on me. So those are the things, the good and the bad.
What about social activities and cognitive stimulation to help prevent or slow down the cognitive decline?
Oh, I didn't mention that. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you
for asking, because that's a big one. And there's more and more evidence from, especially during COVID, because people became even more isolated, that we are social species. The human species, so that's the species we know best, need social interaction. It stimulates our brains. It stimulates our emotions. And that's important. And that's one of the reasons reading books is so important. I mean, when you read a novel, I mean, people often say, so what's it about, the novel? I say, well, there are only three, four subjects. There's love, there's war, there's political travesty. I mean, you know, subjects. I mean, if you say, oh, what's a book about? I say love. So that narrows it down. There are thousands of books about love, and everyone is different. They may have a pattern. Unrequited love. Oh, yeah, that's one pattern. Disloyal love. That's another pattern. You know, we know the stories. I mean, Romeo and Juliet is the prototype of love. And look how that ended. The Iliad. And Paris starts a whole war by running after bringing Helen to him. The face that launched 1,000 ships. And then she finds out he's not such a great guy. That's another story, but we know those stories. But it's important because it stimulates the part of the brain that has to manipulate. So social interaction, cultural impact, music, we know, is very, very important for people who are impaired. I know people who really have trouble. In fact, I saw somebody recently with their cognition, their formal cognition, but they could talk about music. And when I brought it up, they said, oh, yes. And the daughter said, there's music on all the time. What kind of music? Classical music. And it's interesting, people who couldn't remember this and that, I said, who's your favorite composer? Mozart. Right? Now, mine happens to be Rachmaninoff, but that's okay. That's
my father loves Rachmaninoff.
Yeah, I'll tell you a whole story about Rachmaninoff and my life. Okay, so those are the different
interventions. So potentially, Michael, a great activity is dancing. Learning steps, social.
You know what? I feel like a shill. Dancing is phenomenal. So dancing is wonderful for a number of reasons. It's exercise. And for anybody who's done like folk dancing or community dancing, you have to think, you have to remember the steps. It's stimulating, and you have a social group. In one shot, you have it all. Because remember, the brain tells us all the things it have to do, and what it gets back is the stimulus. And the more stimuli that go to the brain, the better.
Yes, yes. So tell me, how can caregivers best support people with mild cognitive impairment?
Well, this is one of the big challenges of the certainly current century, especially in Western countries. And I was just having a communication with somebody because I'm writing a chapter for a book on the Asian community and how they deal with illness and this and that. And I used to do some work at Yihong, which is the Chinese, it's big homes for the aged, all connected. And community is very important. The different communities deal with problems differently. The ethno-cultural religious communities more one way than another way. But communities are a very important source of support. Support for the individuals. A lot of the communities or different kinds of communities have programs. I mean, I can talk from the one I'm at, or was that it was Baycrest. One of my colleagues is Italian, the Villa Colombo community. I know the Chinese community, which I used to do work for, has many programs, the Greek. So those are the ones that are connected to a community that's identified. But then there are many that have no specific identity other than North York, Woodbridge, Etobicoke. Some of them are run by the city. Some of them are run by voluntary nonprofit agencies. And they do a marvelous job of bringing people who might otherwise be homebound. And there's a big, I can't remember the name of it, in San Francisco that was a model. It was all happened to be in the Asian community, but just by chance, that's who started it, of taking homebound, isolated elderly people and bringing them out. They supplied transportation, whatever, bringing them out to a community center and giving them input and support in their own culture. So their own culture includes the right music, the right games, the right interactions. This matters. If it's the wrong ones, the person won't connect.
Right.
So certainly community, starting with, if there's a family, the extended family, even more so. And then whatever exists in the community, I'll tell you, people say, oh, people should age in their home. And I understand why. I love my home. But aging in your home can be very lonely.
And Michael, for my last question, what is the prognosis for individuals with mild cognitive impairment?
Well, a percentage of them, and I can't tell you because these are part of ongoing studies, but a substantial percentage will get diagnosed as mild cognitive impairment, not subjective, but mild, will translate or transform into dementia. Moderate, mild, moderate, severe. But a percentage of them don't. They just stay at mild cognitive impairment. And I can remember one particular woman, because she was a volunteer at Baycrest. She was an unbelievable woman. They used to wear a little pink, overall jacket, and they got a little badge for each year that they were volunteers. And hers looked like something from a general. It went all the way down the side, and she was a volunteer. It's what she said, because that's another thing we didn't mention, kept her going. I said, what do you mean kept me? She says, I have a place to go in the morning. I'm not a nobody. People know me. They speak to me. I have lunch, and I have lunch with other people, right? But she had mild cognitive impairment, according to the rules. I knew her for about 10 years. Nothing changed. She came, she did, she volunteered. She entered into her, as I recall, either late 80s, early 90s, and no decline. And if you look at the literature, mild cognitive impairment does not, and I don't know what the percentages are, transform into further cognitive impairment. And of the foci of research now, because they tried it with the drugs we used for dementia, they didn't work. They didn't stop it going. So now the drugs, as I mentioned earlier, from subjective cognitive impairment and mild cognitive impairment are looking at drugs that affect the chemistry of the brain that we think is one of the causes of Alzheimer's dementia anyway, and trying to transform it so it doesn't progress. So that's a research. And hopefully when we do our next interview about this one in 5 years, as we say, where I come from, you should live so long.
Yes.
We'll do this one again. And the question will be, so what's the update on the dementia preventing medications? And I'll say, wow, I hope so.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. But what I got out of today's episode is essentially what's good for the heart is good for the brain.
That's right. And it's funny, in the world of literature, I could give you the name of 20 books in which the heart and the brain are connected, and they usually love stories in the sense that the brain says, this is not the person, and the heart says, this is, and that's the basis of the book.
Lovely. So thank you so much, Michael, for another informative episode on forgetfulness and mild cognitive impairment. And we will remind our listeners to get out there and start dancing.
Right.
Thank you.
My pleasure.